You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sir Ken Robinson is an internationally recognized leader in the development of creativity and human resources in education and business. What he does is help people discover what they're good at. His 2006 TED Talk has been the most viewed in TED's history, and now he's written a second book on the subject, this one called Finding Your Element, which offers practical advice and exercises to help us discover our most authentic selves. It is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome Sir Ken Robinson to our show today. Hello.
Hello, thanks. Great pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.
Can you define what you mean by element?
I can. You know, I've often been struck, I imagine you have too, by the fact that some people don't enjoy the lives they lead at all. They don't enjoy the work they do. They just sort of get through the week and wait for the weekend. But I also meet people who absolutely love what they do, and they couldn't really imagine doing anything else. You know, if you said to them, why don't you try something else for a change, they'd say, well, I don't know what you mean, because this is who I am. This is when I feel my most authentic. So, you know, the common way we say that is that they're in their element, and it means to me two things. One is that you're doing something that you're naturally good at. You have a flair for it. You get it. I mean, some people walk into a basketball court and they just understand what that's about. Some people walk into a chemistry lab, or they walk into an art studio and they just say, yes, I get this. Some people are that with mathematics. Some people aren't. But to be in your element is more than that. It's not only being good at something, because people often do things they're good at they don't care for. To be in your element, you have to love it. And if you love something you're good at, then you are in your element.
Is that just luck or temperament? How much is determined by family circumstances?
Well, there are all kinds of things. Luck is a slightly slippery term, I think. People often think that luck is pure serendipity and chance. There's a lot of research about luck and people who think they're lucky and people who think they're unlucky. But lucky people often have a different set of attitudes. They're more willing to take a chance. They're more willing to put themselves out. They're more willing to explore new opportunities. Often people who think they're not lucky are reluctant to do any of those things. So one of my big points in the book really is that really what makes a difference in your life is not what happens to you so much as what you make of what happens. It's seeing opportunities and taking them.
But I only can speak for myself. I got this job because my predecessor suddenly died and somebody called me and said, you should apply for this job. Otherwise, I would not have known about it. They had other people who they thought they were going to hire, and it was only because the audience hated them that they that they called me, and here I am 28 years later, in probably my sixth profession. So,
Did your predecessor die in mysterious circumstances?
I didn't know the man, but I probably had somebody help me along those lines. Don't some people just naturally discover their talents and passion over the course
absolutely.
Of their lives?
Of course they do. And one of the ways in which often people do come across their talents is that other people point them out. They have mentors along the way. Very often other people see things in ourselves that we don't see for ourselves. And that's a very important part of this. It's finding other people that you connect with. You see, I mean, can I ask you, what did you have in mind this sort of life when you were at school?
No, I want to be an artist.
And you studied art, I think.
Studied painting.
And
then I worked in advertising, and then I worked in the record business. And
yes.
I did also wrote copy, was an art director, did all sorts of things.
So how did you become aware of this opportunity 28 years ago?
Somebody called me and said, hey, how'd you like to do a show on... I said, okay, I'll try it.
But see, but that's my point, Leonard. You see, somebody else... Well, I'll make two points about that because I think it's always fascinating. People often think that life is linear and that you can plan it out in advance. I mean, I didn't plan my life any more than I imagine you planned yours. You may have intentions. You may have a sense of direction. You may know there are things you want to do and things you'd never do in 1,000 years. But the way your life actually comes together is about the choices you make and the opportunities you take. And somebody else offered the same opportunity you had might have said, look, I don't know anything about that. I won't do it. But you took the opportunity.
On the other hand, some people are just born into it. I just read that 8 members of the Walton family, the Walmart family, have as much money as the bottom 30% of American wage Americans.
Yes.
So we're talking about 8 people having as much money as something like 90 million people.
Yes, that's
they
right.
were born into that.
Yes, that's right.
They may be unhappy, but a lot of us would say, gee, I'd like to be unhappy in the same way.
Well, this is a very interesting issue, isn't it? One of my points in the book is that if you ask most people what they want from their lives or what they want from their children, you can guarantee within the first couple of minutes the word happiness will be used somewhere. And we do often equate happiness with material wealth. And there's no evidence at all that there's a connection. Excuse me. I mean, I came from a large working class family in Liverpool. I live in LA now, but my father worked on the docks. He was a longshoreman, as you would call it here. He'd been a semi-professional sportsman. Most of my family did manual blue-collar work. There was no money around when I was a kid, but we're a very happy group of people. I'm not making this Pollyanna-ish. We weren't the Waltons, you know, and I'm not arguing for poverty either. But if we know
people
anything,
are happier when they're solvent than when they're insolvent.
Well, they are sometimes, you know. Yes, I mean, solvency is good. I'm not arguing for insolvency. I mean, I live in the same world as everybody else. I have bills to pay, and I'm glad to have money to do it with. But what I mean is that beyond a certain level, there isn't a direct gearing between how much money you have and how happy you are. And the reason is that happiness isn't a material state, it's a spiritual state. I don't mean that in the religious sense. It's a state of well-being, a state of fulfillment and satisfaction, often with the relationships you have with other people or the work you do. And just stockpiling money doesn't get you that.
And that's why some people choose to work at low-paying jobs,
yes,
that are satisfying rather than going into better-paying jobs.
I think that's right. I mean, I spend a lot of time in education. My background is in education. I know many, many people in education who do what other people would consider really quite hard, stressful work, but they love it, and they're not well rewarded financially for it.
You begin the book with a fable of two fish swimming down a river. Is part of the problem that people who do discover their element aren't aware of it and therefore haven't been able to create a roadmap for themselves?
Well, that story is, you know, it's an old fable I heard about two small fish in the river, and an older fish swims past in the opposite direction and says, "Good morning, boys, how's the water?" And the little ones swim on a bit, and one turns to the other one and says, "What's water?" Because they have no idea. And you see that when people are in their element, they feel at their most natural. I mean, you know, if you're doing something you love to do, an hour can feel like 5 minutes. If you're doing things you don't care for, 5 minutes feels like an hour. So there isn't, I'm saying, a single point of entry. Sometimes people come across this quite early. Often they don't. And the reason is that being in your element is about understanding your aptitudes, things you're good at. That's part of it. And aptitudes are often buried deep. You have to really have the opportunity to create them. I'm sure, you know, as in your case, you didn't know when you were a teenager that you had the facility to do what you do now. It's not until the opportunity comes along. Never dreamt of it.
But isn't it possible for someone to have the passion for something but not the aptitude?
Yes, it is. Or rather, they're unevenly balanced. You know, a passion for something, what I mean here is a driving enthusiasm, something that you just love to do and an activity that gives you energy. And that's a big difference to me. That's why I make a distinction in the book between physical and spiritual energy. What I mean is, if you're doing something you don't like or much care for, at the end of the week or the end of the day, you can be in physical, you know, good shape physically, but you can be depressed and down. But if you do things you love, you can be physically exhausted but elated by it. I mean, I think it's sometimes watching people run the marathon, you know, they come at the end of it and they're just absolutely elated by it.
On the other hand, we can't all be Major League Baseball players or movie stars.
No, and you don't have to be. I know people who, in every single walk of life, if you can think of an activity that human beings do, there will be people who love it and people who can't bear it. And that's a big theme. It's about the diversity of talents and interests.
But there's obviously a lot of dissatisfaction. Is that the reason there are so many self-help books on the market?
Yes, I think so. I think it's that. I have a lot to say, as you know, about education. I think education often diverts people from their talents. But it's very interesting to note this. I mean, America, and I say it as somebody who lives here now, but America is, by every count, one of the richest countries in the world. As you say, it's very unevenly distributed when nine people have as much as 90 million. But it's nonetheless a country that's devoted in many ways to material well-being. But levels of depression are very high in this country. I was reading recently that sales of antipsychotic drugs, which are ones which used to be available only on clinical prescription, have now overtaken sales of drugs for acid reflux. So I think acid reflux. So it isn't that wealth is lifting. There is a lot of depression and a lack of fulfillment. And I'm not saying if everyone finds their element, it'll solve every problem, but it will certainly help.
Well, we're a country with, I think, the lowest level of social mobility in the Western world, which should be of concern. My guest is Ken Robinson, who with Lou Aronica has written Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. And you mentioned education. Isn't education supposed to be about exploring and finding oneself? That's why we have liberal arts educations. Have our schools been failing us in that quest?
Yes. The short answer is yes, I think they are. And I don't say this in criticism of teachers or of school principals or of superintendents particularly. But there is currently in America, it's not unique to America, but it's certainly a feature here, a tremendous emphasis on standardization in schools, on a narrowing of the curriculum. And for example, this isn't all about the arts by any means. I know people who are absolutely devoted and love the sciences and technology and mathematics. But across the country, since this legislation, No Child Left Behind, was introduced, with its whole culture of standardized testing and schools being closed that don't hit the right data marks, there's evidence that schools across the country have been cutting arts programs, humanities programs, shop classes, physical education. So I think the opportunities have narrowed. There's no question about that.
Well, didn't Britain do something like that? I don't know if you still have the plus 11s, but...
The 11 plus.
11 plus, whatever. It's been a long time since I lived in England. Yeah. But at the age of 11, kids took tests.
Yes.
And the kids who did well in the tests went on to better schools. And the kids who didn't do well were stuck in the equivalent of manual training schools.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm certainly not holding up what's happening in the UK as an example of what should be happening here. I think there are big problems there too, and I've written recently about them. But that was the case. It's a very good example, if I might say so. I mean, in the UK, when I was born in 1950, and we had an Education Act that was introduced in 1944, and it provided for two types of high schools. They were called grammar schools, which were more academic schools, and secondary moderns, which were offered a more basic education. And the way that people were allocated to these schools was on the basis of this test you said, 11 plus, which they took at the age of 11. It was an IQ test, and if they did well, they went to a grammar school, and if they did less well, they went to the other one. Now, what interested me about this was that this was not an exact test. It wasn't like a blood test. It was a question of whether you'd train for it or not. But it stigmatized people for life very often. I know people now being very successful in all kinds of things, but they still carry this burden they didn't pass the 11 plus. And although we've talked about parity of esteem, the expression that was used, we value you equally, it was pretty clear that if you passed the test, you went to this type of school. If you failed, you went to the other one. And people can carry that imprint of their education throughout their whole lives. And if that's part of my argument. You know, if people don't find things in their education that help them discover their talents, if they come away from school feeling they're a bit dumb, it's very hard to shake that off. And often it's because of the culture of education, not because of their talents.
And then on the other hand, there are smart people who like shop classes.
Yes,
so they become stigmatized that way.
Yes,
but in
exactly.
The United States, getting into a competitive college has developed into an industry directed to that end. You have SAT tutors, summer programs where parents pay $10,000 for their children to build wells in Thailand, all for the purpose of creating a resume for college. This process leaves very little room for discovery and creates people who are driven but not passionate.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that there's, you have to be very careful how you say this so you don't I'm not misunderstood. I think we've developed a kind of obsession with people going to college. I'm not arguing against people going to college.
Right now, but it's hard to get a decent job if you don't have a college degree.
Well, the thing is that, you know, when I was at college in the 60s, that when a college degree guaranteed you got a job. It was very unusual if you had a college degree that you didn't get work.
Now it guarantees you the possibility of having an internship.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't guarantee you. It may be the minimum requirement, but it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get the job at all. I mean, I speak to employers all the time, and they're not impressed if somebody says, I've got a degree. They kind of expect that. There's evidence that college graduates earn more money over their lifetimes. That's certainly true. But what's also true in the States is there's a very high dropout rate from high school and from college. And there are very many students who go off unthinkingly to college because it's just the next thing you do after high school. They don't really know why they're there. They don't study there with any great sense of purpose. And when they leave, they're still not sure what to do next. And the other myth, by the way, about this, and it's actually illustrated beautifully, I think, in your own career, is there's very often no direct link between what people study at college and what they're going to do later on in their lives. And we don't tell students that often enough, that if they you know, get pushed to do a certain course because people are advising that this is your best route to employment, it often turns out to be mythical. So I think we should at least look at individual cases. If we have children, we should look at them and say, well, is this the right thing for you? Some people want to do vocational programs. They want to go off and have other experiences, and they want to broaden their horizons before they go to college.
My guest is Sir Ken Robinson, whose follow-up to his books, The Element and Out of Our Minds, is Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. It's published by Viking. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ken Robinson, who with Lou Aronica has written Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. It's published by Viking. How does this book differ from The Element, previous book?
Well, we published The Element in 2009, and it wasn't meant to be a practical guide. It was really wanting to draw attention to these two different ways of living, you know, people who love what they do and those who don't, and what the difference is and what the difference it makes. And it did very well. I think it's now in 23 languages, and we had a lot of fantastic responses to it. But very often people ask me all sorts of questions about it, like, how can I find my element? How can I help my children if they haven't? And the question you asked earlier, for example, which I didn't answer, but I'd be happy to, which was, what if you have a passion for something you're not good at? Or what if you don't have any passions? So there are lots of questions that built up, and I thought I really owe people an answer to this. And so that's what this book sets out to. It's a practical guide to what you can do about these ideas.
Are tests that claim to show your strengths and weaknesses reliable?
They have their strengths and weaknesses, honestly. We did, my son and I took one of these proprietary tests as part of the research for the book. It was 2 3-hour sessions with a battery of different activities. You had to assemble objects, you had to try and remember sequences of musical notes, things like that. So they tried to cover lots of different bases. And some of it was quite interesting. It wasn't a surprise to me that I was better at assembling three-dimensional objects than James, who nearly threw his out the window. He can remember music better than I can. But when we got the results, which were processed by a computer, we almost laughed out loud, because one of the results was that I have a natural gift for interior design. I should have perhaps thought of doing that. My wife didn't stop laughing for the best part of an afternoon. When you look at my colour sense, it's completely risible. And James, we're told, had tremendous foresight and a gift for planning. And he almost didn't get this information because he was 20 minutes late for the meeting. So they do have their strengths. And what I argue in the book is it's interesting and useful to take a lot of these tests, but you should treat them in the way that we treat horoscopes. Take from them what's helpful, but don't feel stereotyped by them.
Well, we all have stories, or most of us, about aptitude tests that were administered in junior high school and gave us outrageous and wrong-headed results. And I was wondering whether that isn't because we know so little about ourselves at that time. You're suggesting that it doesn't matter. Even as adults, you can get absolutely skewed results.
Oh, you can, absolutely. And, of course, these aren't exact tests. It's not like testing if you've got malaria. I mean, it depends what mood you're in on the day and how well-designed the tests are. But they can be helpful. They can be indicative. But I always want to encourage people to resist being stereotyped, either by themselves. You know, there's a battery of tests called Myers-Briggs, and that's some very interesting features to it. But they divide people up into against these criteria. You end up with a four-letter code. So it alleges, you know, there's a certain number of types of people. And my answer to that is, well, it may be helpful to think of some of these things, but there are 7.5 billion people on the planet at the moment, and there are at least that many types of people. Everybody's different. Everybody's unique. I mean, I always ask, if people listening to this have got children, if they have 2 or more children, I bet you they are completely different. I mean, you would never confuse them, would you? It's like, which one are you? Remind me. And it's because our aptitudes are different, our interests are different, our dispositions are different. So what I've tried to do in the book is not offer a 10-step program. I mean, there are 10 chapters in the book, as it turns out, but I can't guarantee you'll be in your element by chapter 10. It's a series of practical exercises, reflective tasks, so that people can really start to explore in more depth what they're good at, the things they've been drawn to in the past, the things they'd like to explore in the future. But they build up cumulatively so that people develop their own profile.
Yesterday, there was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal entitled Dear Grads, Don't Do What You Love by Carl McCoy, and his claim is that we can't all be paid for our passions and that it's the sense of purpose we bring to our work that's more important to fulfillment. Do you agree?
Well, no, Well, I haven't read the article, so I wouldn't want to dismiss it completely. But I'd make a couple of comments based on that summary. One of them is that there's a lot of evidence of very high disengagement at work in the States, not only here, but also in Europe. I mean, startling figures. Gallup has done surveys on this. It shows something over 60% of people at work are actively uninterested in what they're doing.
Is that partly because what we think we should be doing when we go to college, for example, that leads us to go to law school or medical school or into a business school or whatever, may not really be where we should be?
Yes.
And often we're pushed into those things by family pressure.
There's no question. I think that we act on the assumption that life is linear and that you can plan it. It's why the curriculum of schools has become so narrow and focused only on the STEM disciplines, which are very important, you know, that science, technology, engineering, and math. But it's often the case, I'm sure plenty of people listening to this have had the experience of their being applying to college, of being encouraged by parents or friends to take a certain course, you know, do a law degree, do accountancy, so you get into one of these safe professions. There are all kinds of people who love the law and who love accountancy, but very many people who really don't know what they're doing there and why. America has more lawyers per head than any other country in the world.
Well, it's been my experience that at around 35, we see a great number of lawyers leave the profession because they're unsatisfied, and a great number of people go to law school at the same age to get into law because they were unhappy with what they were doing.
Yes, and that's the point, really, that life is very organic. We shift and change, we grow, our interests can move around, and you know, it isn't that you've got one element for life. I mean, people have asked me this. They say, you know, can you have more than one element? And I say, well, look, I'm not legislating here. I'm just trying to point out that this is the case. Often our interests and passions change as we grow and our circumstances change.
My guest is Ken Robinson. His latest book, Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So that's why you say that your element is a personal quest?
Yes. Quest is a medieval term. It's different from a journey in the sense that if you take a journey, you can know exactly where you're aiming to get to and that you've arrived. If you want to set off from New York to San Francisco, you know where it is and you know you've got there. A quest is a journey, but it's a journey where you're not always certain of the outcome, not even maybe sure exactly what you're looking for, but you have a determination and you set out with a sense of purpose. And everyone's journey is different from that point of view. And what I've tried to do in the book is to provide some navigational aids and tools to help them along.
Does finding your element always lead to a new career? Is finding your element always economically rewarding?
No, and the two points about that are, firstly, that some people can't make a living from the thing they love to do, or they don't want to. I know plenty of people say, you know, my real passion is carpentry, you know, or astronomy. They're amateurs in the proper sense of the term. They do because they love it. And they don't want to do it for a living, or perhaps they can't, or they choose not to. So it isn't always that you have to find a work where you're deliriously happy. But the real point about this is it's not only about what you do for a living, it's what you do for a life, what kind of life you have. And you need it somewhere in your life that there's a place in it where you feel that you're most authentic. And it may not be what you do for work, but it should be part of the life you have.
You believe that people should take time between high school and college, go to work? Join the Peace Corps? A listener suggests that people should take a year or two off for national service.
I think it, myself, generally speaking, I think it's often a good idea to take a break between school and college. Again, you have to look at individual circumstances. I know kids who know exactly what they want to do after school and they want to get straight to it. If you don't know and you're feeling a bit jaded with education, it's a very good idea to do something different, to get out in the world for a while. I taught in universities for a long time, and it was often the students who'd been around and done something else who got most benefit from eventually getting to college because they knew what it was there for. It wasn't just another tired thing they had to do.
How would you describe your element, and when did you discover it?
Mine is working with people. I know that. And my wife's always said, we've been together a long time. We've been together about 37 years now, and she says she can always tell what I've been doing during the day. You know, when I was at universities, if I'd been at committees, which is one of my definitions of eternity, you know, to be on a finance committee. But if I'd been doing that, she could tell I came in looking kind of drawn and haggard and, you know, reaching for a drink. But if I'd been working with people, students, or working with groups, or being out and trying to communicate ideas as well as I could, she said you could always tell I I look 10 years younger. So, and I suppose I discovered that in my 20s. But it's to your point. It wasn't that I grew up thinking I need to get in front of people. It's just the work I was doing required that I did. And I found myself in front of large groups in theatres explaining research we'd done. I kind of enjoyed it, and people seemed to connect to it.
And then there are other people who would rather die than appear yes. before an audience.
Absolutely. And I actually tweeted recently. I have to admit this, Leonard. I tweet these days. And I did this tweet asking people if they could name jobs that they would hate that they think other people love. And we got the normal list of things. I got hundreds of replies, by the way. People were saying things that, you know, like proctologist. Well, you know, proctologists presumably love what they do, and I'm glad they do. It's very important it's done. I did a session a while ago with the U.S. Association of Pathologists, and these are a very impassioned group of smart, interesting people, but it's not a field I could have walked into. I should just say, by the way, at the end of it, I often, you know, you're often given a gift at the end of these events by the conference organised, and I was offered a free autopsy, which I thought I haven't cashed it in yet. But
you originally planned to call your first book Epiphany, didn't yes. you? Why did you change it to Element, and what were the consequences?
Well, it's interesting because the reason we were going to call it that was it was a holding title. For some people, there is a before and after moment. They come across me and think, this is it. I remember, actually, I did an interview a couple of years ago with a regional radio in the Midwest, and the guy who was interviewing me said that, I asked him how he got into radio, and he said he went on a school trip to a radio station when he was 14, and his friends all wandered around and thought it was interesting to out. He said, I was captivated the minute I walked in the studio. I couldn't believe it. And he said, I've got to spend my life in this. And he said, I've been in radio ever since. Somebody else walked into a kitchen in a restaurant. And he said he was going to be an engineer. He walked into the kitchen. He was overtaken by the whole thing. Sometimes it's like that, but often it's not. It's more like falling in love gradually. And so it didn't seem quite the right title to capture the variety of ways in which people find their element.
And sometimes it's something you're just forced into. You talk about your yes. father having an injury and having to find something else to do. So yes. Often people are fired from a job and they can't get back into yes. A similar job, and they discover something else.
It's the necessity is the mother of invention, that's right. I mean, I said in the book, until I was 4, my family was convinced I was going to be a soccer player. My father certainly was. But then I got polio. There was these big polio epidemics in England, America in the 50s. And obviously that put paid to that as a career choice. I hadn't made the choice, but my family were encouraging. So, yeah, I pushed in some other directions. And I think we all have deep resources, and it's not necessarily just one thing. Some people know right away. I know a concert pianist I talked about in the previous book who gave up playing the piano because she realized even though she was good at this and she kept doing it, it wasn't what she loved to do. She loved books, and in her late 30s, she changed direction completely.
Do you think that formal education sometimes gets in the way of finding your element?
Absolutely, it does.
Or
yes.
even knowing your IQ?
Well, yes, and actually IQ is one of the problems, I think, that we've come to reduce all the complexities of intelligence to a number, as if it tells you all you need to know. And it doesn't take, I mean, IQ tests don't test for whether you can play the saxophone or whether you can paint or whether you can perform a dance or do gymnastics. It's a very limited conception of intelligence that they promote.
You mentioned earlier that some people have no passions. I can't imagine that.
No, some people think that. They say they don't. I'm not saying they don't. I mean, and what I've tried to do in the book is to give them a way of finding those things out. But what I was going to say is that sometimes, as you said, people may have a high passion for things they don't feel they're very good at. And they may actually be underestimating how good they are at things because of the standards they set. But I think, generally speaking, passion and enthusiasm, high passion aligned to a moderate talent, will take you further than low enthusiasm for something you're very good at.
On the other hand, we have all sorts of jobs that most people think are not attractive, like trash collecting or working as a messenger or doing housework and ironing and such. And yet, those things have to be done.
Yes,
do people develop passions for them?
Some do, actually. I had a whole conversation with somebody who's an office cleaner, and she absolutely loves it. And I mean, generally does. And she has it's the part of the day she has children where she feels most fulfilled. And she loves the work. She loves the satisfaction of seeing it done, and gets a great deal from it. Now, I'm just saying that we should never rush to judgment about what other people enjoy doing. The fact we don't like it doesn't mean they might not. I know people who couldn't bear to work with animals and other people who couldn't imagine doing anything else, people who couldn't bear to work outdoors, and some people who couldn't think of being in an office all day. I mean, that's the whole point about diversity. But as I say, it's not just what you do for a living. It's finding a balance in your life so that you wake up in the day enthusiastic about some part of it.
Why do you think your TED Talk took off the way that it did?
Well, there's a couple of things, really. And it has been seen very widely. We think it's been seen by, well, it's been viewed online over 25 million times. And I mean, that's not Gangnam Style. I understand that. But I don't have the moves, you know. But it's shown a lot at events and conferences. So we think it's probably been seen by maybe 200 to 300 million people in 150 countries. I think, you know, it's entertaining. That's true. It's short. That's always a big help. It's not an hour. It's 18 minutes. So it's not too much of a trial. It's a glass of wine, you know. But none of that would matter if it didn't resonate. I think people just feel it's true. I get emails from kids, from parents, from teachers, from business leaders, from all saying how much it's helped them. I think it just resonated. People feel that what I'm saying is the case, and I feel that. I've been doing this a long time, and I have lots of evidence for it.
Is it the reason you were knighted?
The TED Talk, no. Actually, I was at an event about 2 months ago, and somebody said to me at the university, said, "You've been at this a long time now, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What is it, 7 years?" I said, "Why did you say 7 years?" He said, "No, that TED Talk in 2006. I said, "Yes, but I was alive before that. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I wasn't born at TED." No, I was knighted for all the work I did in the arts in the UK and in education, and it was a great privilege.
And then you left and moved to LA. But that's a whole other story.
I had already left, but I hadn't left with the intention of never going back. This was just a new phase. This is all part of that organic thing, isn't it? We thought we'll come here for a while and see how this is.
And you found Los Angeles is your element. Ken Robinson's book is called Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. It's published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's my pleasure, Leonard. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.